And welcome to the Further Podcast, where we explore the far reaches of the human experience, from missions to Mars, to skydiving, to blowing one's mind with psychoactive substances. These conversations offer insight into how these extreme experiences showcase the human spirit and just might teach us how to live our everyday lives a bit better. I'm your host, Haley Maria Duran, and I study the effects of psychedelics and other out there experiences on people's minds and brains.
All right. So in this episode, I talk with Dr. Alex Seeloff about how psychedelics may or may not help us cope with the fear of death. It's interesting because Alex studied with Jeff Greenberg, who is one of the founders of terror management theory. You might be wondering, what exactly is terror management theory? What is existential psychology? This is not something that's brought up in the realm of psychedelics where everything's mystical or ego dissolution, or now we're getting more stuff, I suppose, with like emotional breakthroughs and insight, but still, there hasn't really been a lot of existential psychology exploring how psychedelics could be helpful. So I really enjoy how Alex's research takes a new perspective and examines psychedelics through these other lenses. And he also studies breathwork as well. He conducted a study where he examined whether breathwork could elicit mystical experiences and if it had any sort of psychological impact on people, and also studied psychedelics within a naturalistic setting. He talks a bit about how he went around at a festival stirring people and then did a longitudinal study of that. And I really appreciate this research because, you know, despite all the excitement over these clinical trials, for a good bit of time, I think more, psychedelic use is going to be happening mostly in the wild. And understanding what sort of effects that may or may not have on people is really important. So I appreciate that he conducted the study, even though some of the results might not be all that impressive. We'll get into that a bit in the interview. And yeah, the sort of existential psychology framework and terror management theory, I don't necessarily agree with all of it. I think that some of the lens on how mental illnesses develop might be a bit problematic, but you know, it's another framework to think about these experiences from. And I think the nice thing about theory is that it can inform what sort of questions we're asking. And then if we're going out there studying things from an angle we haven't thought of before, we're gathering more data, right? And more interesting, nuanced data, I would hope. So I do appreciate it from that perspective. We do get a bit into the theory, as you might expect, but I think it is interesting and it is relevant, understanding how death might, just the tangential, I guess, awareness of death that people always have might be impacting them. I think that is a worthwhile topic to think about. And I enjoy how he tries to make sense of a bunch of different human behaviors from this lens. So I really do appreciate that as well. We also get into something a bit fun. Alex is really into skydiving and has done over 150 jumps. And you might think, oh, terror management, existential psychology person jumping out of a plane. They're just testing their anxiety buffers. Apparently not, according to Alex. And it's funny, you know, hearing him discuss his experience in skydiving, I think I've decided that I will definitely do it at some point. So maybe even record a podcast of my reaction, which would probably be bad, knowing me. Yeah, but We will see.
All right. So I am here with Dr. Alex Seeloff today, and he has done some rather intriguing work examining psychedelics from the lens of terror management theory and existential psychology. I find this particularly interesting because there have been a lot of sort of theoretical frameworks tossed around for how psychedelics work, but few of them really address how people might make lasting changes in their lives. And I think from existential psychology, perhaps we can learn a bit more. Or at least that's how Alex started some of his research. So maybe you could tell us a bit about what led you to be interested in existential psychology and psychedelics.
Sure, yeah. And thanks for having me on here, Haley. Yeah, I guess falling into existential psychology in specific felt like a mix of like exactly where I was trying to get to, but also a bit of just happy coincidence. Because in undergrad, I took a social psychology class. I think it was my sophomore year. Or I guess it was a little bit complicated because I was a non-traditional student. I had a bunch of prior credits from studying information technology management. That's a whole other thing. But in my social psychology class, my professor was Dr. Tom Pazinski, and he happened to be one of the founders of terror management theory. So while I was taking his class, I just became more and more interested in social psychology. I thought I had a good sense that social psychology was the direction I wanted to go for a PhD. I was kind of between that and industrial organizational psychology at the time. Part of the coincidence is that I wasn't able to take an industrial organizational psychology class in undergrad because that's what I was leaning towards more at the time. But just the timing of when they offered the class, it was only offered like every other year and like conflicted and stuff. So, but then in social psychology, I was just super interested. I would stay after class asking Tom questions, and I would go to office hours and just talk to him about theory and kind of toss ideas around and stuff. And he eventually asked me if I wanted to join his research lab as a research assistant. And so then I started getting more experience in the lab, and he kind of just took me under his wing. And it was also just like the perfect place for me to end up because of the sort of questions I was interested in asking and finding answers to through research. Because I was interested in like bigger, overarching, deeper questions that had to do with a lot of aspects of life, not just like kind of a lot of research ends up being a little bit more, narrow-minded and focused, whereas existential psychology, I like to describe it as like kind of being, it's always at play, it's always under the surface at any given moment. And so the sort of questions that existential psychology was answering were very interesting to me. So yeah, it was kind of the intersection of a couple things that made me more interested in it.
So what would be some examples of like the quintessential existential psychology questions that you were asking?
The one at the time when I was in undergrad that kind of kept me up at night was, why do people believe weird things? In this sense of like the fact that every single person believes something weird, if we think about it, it's like, and weird is, it's also relative. So like what's weird to me, is not weird to somebody else. And so in that sense, it's like, why do people believe weird things? It's like, we all, there's somebody out there that everybody thinks is weird for what they believe. And so I was like, why do people believe those things? And what makes that kind of the case? So that's one of the questions that led me into it. And then in a roundabout way, learning about terror management theory kind of answered that question in the sense that, I guess we can get into that at some point and hear like how terror management theory kind of answers that question. That then led me to wonder a little bit more about, like once I had that question answered, I was like, okay, I kind of feel like I have an understanding of why people believe weird things. It kind of has to do with this like awareness of death and everything. But that just like opened up a whole new can of worms of questions that I ended up exploring with my research.
Yeah, it seems like thinking about, you know, weird experiences and weird beliefs people can have can be the catalyst for so many different research directions. So I definitely understand where you're coming from with that. But for people who don't know about terror management theory, maybe you could explain the basics of that a bit.
Sure, yeah. So terror management theory, it starts on the work of Ernest Becker, who is a cultural anthropologist. He wrote a book called Denial of Death, and that has to do with how the human awareness of our own inevitable mortality impacts us psychologically. And so this awareness of mortality is a little bit different than like a general sense of awareness of death, like that animals might have. Like they, like an animal might be aware that like their buddy just died or that they can die. It's like this awareness that, oh, I can die if a predator gets me, or if I don't end up getting food or something, I could die. But this awareness is more like kind of combined with our ability to project into the future and see that no matter what we do, even if I always have all the food I'm going to need, I can escape all the predators, whoever chased me or whatever. No matter what I do, I'm going to die at some point in the future. And it's also this awareness that I could die at any moment for any number of unpredictable reasons also. You know, like, especially with humans beginning having this awareness of like a meteor, asteroid could hit at any moment too, or like an earthquake or some natural disaster that's outside of our hands, or an active shooter, or, you know, getting hit by a bus or something. There's all sorts of things that could happen. Medical situation that you didn't know about, your heart failure or something. So this awareness of death, as Ernest Becker proposed it, it impacts us and kind of arouses this sort of existential terror. And the idea is that if we didn't find some way to manage that terror, we would be debilitated by it. Because what's the point in doing anything if we're going to die someday anyways? Because part of like the whole point in living is like we're trying to do all these things to avoid death, you know, avoid discomfort, move towards pleasure and stuff. But like, what's the point in doing all that? So the idea is that we would kind of just be reduced to this pile of like useless goo laying there and just die, because what's the point in doing anything? Kind of this like ultimate depressive state. So he proposed that we manage that terror by, and this is where terror management theory started kind of studying these things empirically. The idea is that we manage that terror by a three-part anxiety buffer system. And this is one of the big parts of terror management theory. The first part is a worldview. So belief in some sort of worldview that provides some sense of lasting immortality after we die. So we gain that through either some sense of literal or symbolic immortality. Our worldview beliefs can contain, you know, literal beliefs in an afterlife, where like if I do the right things during my life, then I can gain everlasting life in some literal afterlife. A symbolic immortality is more of a sense of like an enduring impact on the world after I die. So leaving some sort of legacy. You know, some people get this through, you know, having a building named after you. Lots of universities have, you know, things named after them, writing a book, making some sort of piece of art, creating a business. Like there's all sorts of ways, and having children, there's all sorts of ways that people can live on after they die, so to speak. And so belief in a worldview that kind of provides that sense of a lasting life, and then self-esteem. And so that's the second part of the anxiety buffer. So we earn self-esteem by living up to our worldview beliefs, because our worldview beliefs kind of create this, they're like the blueprint for how we earn self-esteem. So if we live up to our beliefs, we gain self-esteem. And that is all kind of buffered by the third part of the anxiety buffer, which is close relationships. So we typically maintain close relationships with people who believe similar things. That way, if I do something that I think is of value, that my worldview says is like, yes, that's a good thing to do, it's of value, the other people around me can see me doing that and say, good job. I kind of buffering that self-esteem even more. So through this belief in our worldview beliefs, living up to the standards of value in our worldview beliefs, and then maintaining relationships with people who believe similar things, we end up kind of having this sense of value and purpose, that we have some sense of like that we're going to live on forever because of it. Even though it's not like that's, for most people, that's not really like an explicit reason that they believe those things and everything. This is all kind of like under the surface. That's kind of the gist of terror management theory.
I didn't realize that initially it was developed from a cultural anthropology lens. That's unique. What sort of cultures was he looking at?
Well, he was actually, he transcended fields. He wasn't really like he pulled from a lot of other fields of study, philosophy, sociology, psychology heavily. He was influenced heavily by Freud and Ronk. And he wasn't like, to say that he was a cultural anthropologist doesn't quite do it justice. Yeah, he really pulled from all of the social sciences.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to build a theory and to have it be somewhat comprehensive. You really need to pull a lot of pieces together. But one interesting thing that you mentioned about terror management theory is it seems to suggest that having stronger beliefs is actually helpful for people. And, you know, people might think, oh, that's kind of, I know eventually you're going to get into how this theory might sort of interact with psychedelics. It's kind of weird that psychedelics supposedly could kind of match up with a theory that is about building stronger beliefs. So,
yeah, that's a good catch. And there's this that makes me think of one of my favorite, I guess one of my favorite articles. It was a chapter written where one of the things they talk about in that chapter, the chapter was written by the people who founded terror management theory. They talk about being stuck between a rock and a hard place in the sense of like what we believe in and where we gain our sense of value and everything. And this is in the sense of like, the rock is belief in like a very sure, very concrete belief that like my perspective of reality and my beliefs about the world are correct and everybody else is wrong, essentially. And it's this very sure sense of like right and wrong and what to do with our lives, what we should be doing. And the thing is that that kind of belief is in some ways technically, I guess it gets kind of complicated, but it's sort of... simple terms, it's better for managing death anxiety because it gives you this like sure sense and you can be very confident. And especially if you have a lot of other people around you who believe in that very sure sense of it, you get that kind of extra buffer. And whereas the other side of this is like, so that's the rock. And then the hard place is allowing more uncertainty, allowing for like, I don't actually know, but that doesn't manage that. How that doesn't manage death anxiety as well is that it doesn't give you a sure sense that like what you're doing is like the quote unquote correct thing to be doing in life, like how you're spending your time, what you're like investing yourself in. Like what if you do all that and then like 10 years down the road, maybe you learn something new that kind of nullifies everything you've been doing in a sense. Like that's dramatic. It's probably not going to work out quite that way, but allowing for more uncertainty, allowing for the fact that like you don't know everything. The idea is that it wouldn't manage death anxiety as well because of that, like kind of, you don't know that you're going to get that enduring sense of value after you die. And so it might be more anxiety inducing to live that way. But it's also more like open-mindedness to other ways of life being okay. Because one of the downsides, of course, of like having this like very sure sense of the right and wrong and that like your way of seeing the world is correct and everybody else is wrong, is that that is much more likely to lead to like interpersonal conflict, a war, in ways that are very like, I'm right and you're wrong and I'm going to destroy you because of it. One of the more like applicable times, like one of the things that brought terror management theory into the public eye a little bit more was after 9/11, because it was a very relevant theory at that time because America was attacked by people who believed something different ideologically. And we retaliated in ways that terror management theory would predict because like we need to ensure that like our way of seeing the world is the correct way. And if we destroy them, that kind of like makes us feel better about like, oh yeah, see, we were right because they're gone now. But so that's obviously one of the huge downsides of living your life with the rock sort of worldview, is that it creates a lot more conflict, allows a lot more room for kind of bad juju between groups who believe different things. Whereas a person who has this more like the hard place is living in this more sense of like uncertainty, sense of like there's lots of different ways of seeing the world. There's a little bit more openness there. But it's harder to hold that all. Mm-hmm. So that's a fun dynamic to think about. I think the world would be a better place if more people embraced the hard place. But it's hard. It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell. It's a lot. It's called the hard place for a reason.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense how beliefs can be both helpful. Like you think about, you know, the kind of community that people can have around a religion or other just belief systems and how that can be, you know, helpful for social cohesion and whatnot, but then also 9/11 and other terrible things that have happened throughout history. But, you know, this all sounds a bit different than the mode of transcendence that you thought that psychedelics might be able to elicit. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that mode.
Yeah. So where to start with this? So we have these worldview beliefs. We get them by the process of like acculturation, where as we're being raised as kids, we're taught our belief systems by our parents, by the culture we're in. And that's where we gain this sense of like, oh, this is how to live life. And that's going to be different, of course, like from country to country, even from like state to state within the United States, like things can be slightly different. So we get this sense of like what to do. And then that can provide that generally falls into like terror management theory. Generally, the worldview beliefs and the sense of immortality generally fall into five different categories of death transcendence. The first four kind of fit into what I've been talking about this whole time, which are biosocial, which is like gaining sense of immortality by the bio part of that is having kids and kind of passing on your genes, passing on your belief systems to your kids. The social part of that is by belonging to social groups that are larger and more enduring than the personal self. So like identification as like a patriot, an American patriot. If I kind of attach myself to this group of Americans and the idea that America will live on longer than I personally will, or even like a football team or, I don't know, hobbies. There's lots of different things that people can identify with that like belonging to that group and upholding the standards of value that that group believes in kind of provides you a sense of enduring value after death because the group will endure beyond death. That's biosocial. Theological is the religious answer. So believing in, and that often comes with a belief in an afterlife. So literal immortality. And then so biosocial, theological, creative is through creative works of art, or kind of generally broadly defined, where like if I create something new that's coming from me and I put it out into the world and that thing can endure longer than me, I can gain a sense of immortality. The fourth one is the natural mode of death transcendence, which is kind of identifying oneself as part of nature. And that like, for example, just like when I die, the atoms of my body will be returned to the earth and recycled, and like the atoms of my body will physically live on past my own death, even though I like my personal identity won't. So you can identify as part of nature, and then that can like build into your belief system by like becoming an environmentalist or something. So then there's this fifth mode of death transcendence. And by the way, these all come from Dr. Robert J. Lifton developed these, and then he influenced the development of terror management theory. But the fifth mode works a little bit differently because it's not a belief system. And that's the experiential mode of death transcendence, which is what you were just alluding to. And that's where psychedelics come in. That's where non-ordinary states of consciousness come in. And it works differently because it's more of a temporary state than it is a belief system to believe in all the time. So non-ordinary states of consciousness being able to be induced by lots of different things. Some of the things that he talked about, of course, we just mentioned psychedelics. There's more transcendent forms of breathwork, dancing, singing, sex, even sometimes like a really intense illness can make people kind of like, it's kind of that, like if you think of when, if you're really, really sick, you kind of have this like much looser sense of like reality and what's real and stuff. If you're all drugged up, you're kind of like coming in and out of it. Yeah, there's a handful more that I'm not thinking of right now, but the experiential mode works differently. And that's where my research was really focused in terror management theory, was trying to find a place like, how do I empirically test some of these ideas? Because everything I've been talking about with terror management theory so far has been empirically validated in the sense that there's been a couple thousand studies testing these core assertions of terror management theory. And there hasn't been as much research into that experiential mode of death transcendence. And that's what I was trying to do. And there hasn't been a lot of research there because it's a really challenging thing to study in a research environment in the lab. Like, how do you get people to have that kind of experience in a research lab, which is like antithetical to like being in that kind of a state? Because things that like, in my own personal life, and this is where like the intersection of like how I came to study what I do also kind of intersects with like certain things I do in my life, like snowboarding and skydiving and canoeing and backpacking and doing all these kind of adventurous things, because those are a way that I get into experiential transcendence, meditation, yoga. And so the idea is like, okay, my question was how do these fleeting experiences like impact this anxiety buffer system, our belief systems? And then like it was also had to do with mental health and how like mental health fits into this, which like terror management theory kind of has a perspective about mental health. I don't know if maybe we can touch on that in a little bit, but yeah. So the way that I saw experiential transcendence fitting into terror management theory is that we go into these non-ordinary states of consciousness, and in that temporary state, our belief systems that typically manage our death anxiety kind of get quieter to some extent, and they're not influencing our actions in that moment. They're not influencing like our thoughts as much in that moment. They're less accessible. And this is shown in stuff like the Rebus model, relaxed beliefs under psychedelics with Robin Carhart-Harris and stuff. And there's been some other research showing similar things of like decreased activation in the parts of our brain that are thought to be associated with, I guess, it's like the default mode network and all that. It's like kind of reducing the like strong priors in our belief systems. So the idea is that like in that moment, we're managing death anxiety by basically not thinking about death. We're so in the moment, and we're so like consumed and absorbed in the experience we're having that thoughts of death aren't able to creep up, but then also like not being able to think about our belief systems and stuff. But the idea is that we kind of get more in touch with some truer sense of what we really feel in that moment. That's kind of like brushed away from all those like belief systems that we've put on top of who we really are that are shaping us. Because if we want to take a kind of a binary perspective of this for a moment, say like culture tells us how to act, how to be, and we could develop our entire identity by culture telling us who we are. And then that whole life, you've developed your identity based on something coming from outside of yourself. But then on the other side of this, and this is only if we're looking at it as binary, which isn't actually the case, but if we look at the other way, like if a person was able to develop their sense of identity purely based on their own likes, their own desires, their own like what they want to do in life, which again, this isn't really possible because like we're raised in a culture and it just happens, but that would be a person who's like entirely driven by intrinsic motivation, and we could call it intrinsic is a sense of like really believing in what you're doing. It's coming from within oneself rather than extrinsic, which is what we were just talking about, where there's it's coming from outside of oneself. And so something non-ordinary states of consciousness do is they get people in touch with their intrinsic beliefs, like what they really and not even just beliefs, but their sense of like what they really feel connected to. And let's say I could go a couple different directions with this, but to bring it back to modes of death transcendence, how it fits into terror management theory, part of where I think non-ordinary states of consciousness help manage death anxiety and like develop worldview beliefs and stuff that are helpful for managing death anxiety is that we can go into these temporary states of non-ordinary states of consciousness and kind of get in touch with what we really feel about something. And then we can come back after the state has ended, after we're back to our like, I don't know, ordinary waking consciousness, and integrate those insights that we had during our non-ordinary state into our worldview beliefs and live our life in a way that feels more in alignment with who we really feel we are. And so, you know, that can happen in smaller, big ways. You know, maybe going snowboarding and having a good time on the mountain might not be like the most insightful experience. Like, I'm not going to like have a revelation about how I want to live my life, or maybe I will. But it's more about like loosening up and like physically. I experience it as kind of a like I physically feel it in my body more relaxed and more just receptive. Whereas if I don't do something to get into these non-ordinary states, whether it's my snowboarding or my hiking or yoga meditation, I physically feel tense in my body. And this isn't a very scientific part of it. Like, I don't know where this fits in necessarily, but there's something there where like, if I feel that tenseness, I'm less receptive to, I don't know what's going on around me. I'm less receptive to like really listening like in a deep way to what is going on in my environment around me. And I'm less in touch with my own intrinsic self if I'm in that more tense state all the time. But yeah, I guess like to sum it up, the integration is where it really like everything kind of comes to a head. Cause that's where like, if I integrate what I experienced in this non-ordinary state into my worldview, I could then live in a way that feels more in alignment, feels better to me, and I really believe in what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's intriguing because it seems like you're suggesting that these experiential modes, it can come from both small things and large things. And also, it really doesn't seem to matter all that much, maybe if it's a positive or negative experience. Like you mentioned, how people can have these experiential transcendent moments when they're extremely ill. Kind of reminds me of pivotal mental states a bit, but it sounds like you're just really interested in understanding experiences that kind of take people out of, you know, just their thoughts looping in the everyday and allow people to experience the world in a more present way, I suppose, where they're paying more attention to how their body feels, it sounds like. And whatnot. Yeah. But it also seems like, at least for you, you focused on psychedelics specifically a bit. What drew you to that experiential mode especially?
Yes, that was kind of the route into this broader topic in general, because I think of like non-ordinary states are the broader topic, and psychedelics are like one method of accessing that. My way into the psychedelics and researching them was, I guess it started after I got out of the military. So I was in the Air Force for 9 years. And when I got out of the military in 2015, I was living in Colorado at the time, and marijuana was legal, and I had never tried it in my life. I was 27. I had a passing interest in trying it. I was like, hey, I have this extra freedom now that I couldn't do while I was in the military. So why not? It's legal here. So I tried it, and it was nothing like what like the DARE program taught me it was. Like I went through the DARE program as a kid, and they told me all sorts of things. And it just wasn't, it didn't lead up to those meet those expectations at all. It was so much more mild and like laid back and just, I mean, it was fun and relaxing. I was like, wow, this is nothing like what they taught me. I was like, kind of opened the question of like, what else did they lie to me about? But I'm much more of a like, I'm going to research things before I do them. Like even with marijuana, I read a bunch, I talked to a lot of people, and I like did it in this very controlled environment at home by myself for the first time. And like, so I'm a very like, I don't know, I'm just more conservative in that way, where I'm like not gonna just go out and like, oh, I'm at a party, someone like gives me something, like, oh, what's this? I don't know, try it. I'm not like that sort of person. So I did start asking the questions of like, what else did the DARE program lie to me about? And so I started researching the other drugs that were out there and learned a little bit about like, oh, some of them really aren't that great. Like, yeah, you want to stay away from heroin and crack and stuff. But these psychedelics things are really interesting, especially when I start reading more books about them and listen to podcasts. And so that just started kind of a rabbit hole that I was going down in my undergrad while I was learning about terror management theory. Kind of consequentially, I was like, had my professional life where I was in school and I was learning about terror management theory and death and stuff. And then on the side, I was like starting to read books and listening to these podcasts and stuff, learn about psychedelics. And that's when I saw the connection of like, okay, I'm learning about death anxiety, how we manage this. A lot of people on psychedelics report like they think they've died, or they feel like that there's some sense of death connection there. Ego death is talked about. And like a lot of people say that like from this experience of thinking they died or having some sort of confrontation with death, they feel like they, you know, changed in some way for the better because of that experience that they had on psychedelics. And that's where I started, like, that's where my research questions kind of, I guess, started, even though I didn't realize it at the time, is like, because that's what ended up being my main topic of research. So that's where I became interested in psychedelics, was, I guess marijuana was a gateway drug for me of sorts.
So I guess another thing that we didn't talk about much is terror management's ideas around mental health and how these, you know, death anxiety buffers might be helpful, and maybe how psychedelics can fit into that.
Yeah, I'm glad we circled back to that. So the perspective that terror management theory would take on mental health is, it is a theoretical perspective. So if we consider the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that where all of the diagnoses for psychological disorders lives, that manual takes an atheoretical perspective, which means that it doesn't take any sort of stance about how people come to have these kind of symptom clusters. Because that's what all, like anxiety, depression, OCD, they're symptom clusters in the DSM. It's just like, okay, if people have these sort of symptoms arising, they fit this category, they get that diagnosis, and that's kind of the end of the story. They don't really look into like, okay, but how did they develop? That's where the it's a theoretical. It doesn't try to take a perspective on that, which has very good reasons in the history of psychology and stuff and where that comes from, because we don't need to get into that. But terror management theory is kind of a theoretical way of looking at mental health diagnoses. And the way I'm about to describe it doesn't apply all the time, but it's a pretty good general rule of thumb, is that terror management theory would say that these mental disorders that people can get, the symptoms, actually I won't think about it in terms of like the actual diagnoses. Let's just think about it, the symptoms that people get that lead to the diagnoses are kind of a result of not adequately managing death anxiety. So this starts at the question of like, what happens if a person is not adequately managing death anxiety? Well, we become like partially debilitated by it. You know, I mentioned earlier when I was describing terror management theory, if we didn't do something to manage death anxiety, we would become debilitated by it. We would be that like little useless pile of goo that would just like eventually die of starvation or getting eaten by an animal or something. Because we became just like, oh, I'm going to die. What's the point? This is the idea that like, if we're not adequately managing death anxiety, say we're like, our anxiety buffering system is only working to a small extent or hardly working at all, we would start developing symptoms that our culture identifies in the DSM, in that diagnostic manual. And, you know, that's going to show up differently for each person. And I think it'd be one of the thoughts I had if I were to stay in academia and keep doing that research would be to try to figure out like, okay, how does a person come to develop anxiety instead of depression? How do they develop OCD instead of, you know, something else? But that research has not been done, but that would be a fun way to go. But in a broader sense, the idea is that these mental health symptoms, a lot of them are the result of mismanaged death anxiety. And so we try to gain some of them is like trying to regain a sense of control over our lives by like having something that's within our locus of control. So something like OCD or an eating disorder or something, part of the way I think of it is like it's a new immortality project. And I guess I haven't used that word before, but it was this in this interview at least. But immortality projects are kind of what I was describing earlier, like the sense of it's the project that we work on that gives us a sense of immortality, that gives us a sense of enduring value. The word comes from Ernest Becker, but immortality project could be for a person like typically healthy, at least defined by our culture, is like doing something that's culturally relevant and culturally acceptable. You can get your immortality project that way. But a person who is debilitated and not adequately managing death anxiety and develops some sense of obsessive or compulsive tendencies is kind of like their immortality project is like, I'm going to spend my time and my days on these like kind of repetitive tasks because it's something I can control. But to zoom back out a little bit more, like it's, I guess I don't know where I want to go with it. Maybe I'll just pause there and see what questions you have.
Yeah, I guess that sort of explains how terror management theory could be looked at from the men's lens of how mental health conditions develop in a sort of transdiagnostic way. And then, you know, psychedelics are also something that a lot of people are saying could be somewhat transdiagnostic. So maybe there's some sort of underlying fit there, I suppose.
Yeah. So I think that's a real helpful way to look at it is because like, psychedelics are being used to treat, like there's ongoing trials for treating all sorts of different diagnoses. And they're interesting in that sense because like most drugs that are developed nowadays, like the drug manufacturers are creating them like, oh, I want to create this drug to treat like this specific diagnosis. But again, like those, at the end of the day, those are just symptom clusters that weren't really, like the DSM created them because it's like, we recognize that like, oh, like people tend to have, you know, if they have such and such symptoms, they kind of like fall into a similar group, which isn't really like the most scientific way to go about that process. But it's helpful for treatment. And that's what from my understanding, I believe that's a big benefit of the DSM is that it's more helpful for treatment than it is for like being totally accurate and true about like what is actually going on and how those things came to be. Because people with these similar symptom clusters, we can help that group of people by doing, you know, X, Y, and Z treatments. So, but like, if we look at this other way of treating things, psychedelics and non-ordinary states of consciousness, they seem to help for across lots of diagnoses, so trans-diagnostic beyond a single diagnosis. And yeah, I do think terror management theory has a way of looking at it that's a little bit more helpful for like looking at, for understanding how that's all happening. More helpful, at least compared to like the way the DSM looks at it and like traditional, like kind of contemporary clinical psychology. Because like coming from the background I have in social psychology, existential psychology, like I am not bound by the DSM in the same way that a clinical psychologist would be, which is something I've really appreciated. Early in my studies, my advisor was like, oh, you're kind of asking clinical questions. Like, have you thought about getting a clinical psychology PhD? And I was like, no, like, I don't like the way that that constricts the way that I think. And so, yeah, I've kind of been more free to think about mental health in a different way than a clinical psychology student would have been. And I think that's really helpful when it comes to psychedelics. So we're trying to like understand a mechanism of action that seems very different. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely see how, you know, somebody having a full-blown mystical type experience could fit into that experiential mode of transcendence. And then people come out of it and are able to develop, you know, ways of living that are more in line with their belief systems. But then also there are experiences people can have with psychedelics where they're just completely panicking, convinced that they're dying. And yet sometimes even then, you know, they come out of it with some sort of insight or appreciation some of the time. So
Yeah. So Robert Lifton talked about when he was describing the experiential mode of transcendence in his book, Broken Connection. One of the things that he focused on to like kind of give it some context that'll be helpful here is that looking at cultural rituals where it's marking some sort of transition. So our American culture these days doesn't really have a lot of that. We have like birthdays and whatnot, but it's not the same as like, I'm trying to think, I'm coming to a blank about some of these specific. Well, one of the rituals that I'm thinking of that was someone wrote about this that really stood out to me, and I'm forgetting who wrote it now or what paper I was getting this from, but his name's at the tip of my tongue. Anyways, it was about like a tribe leader. So think of like 100 to a couple hundred people in a tribe. The leader of that tribe goes through this ritual on an annual basis where it's like part of what he has to go through to maintain that like leader status. And in this ritual, it starts by kind of stripping him of his status as like the leader. And he comes down in among his tribe, and he's not just an equal as everybody, but he's almost less than them. And they can, during this ritual, he can be demeaned. People can like yell names at him. But the whole time they're going through this, he's going through this ritual, It's a really intense experience for him, but his culture that the tribe has created has like kind of created the expectations of what that ritual is going to be. And so like, it's this way where like he's taken out of the culture in that moment, just for that little temporary experience. And he's like put through the ringer of this whole ordeal that they go through in the ritual, whether it's like physical maiming or psychological maiming. And he's kind of put in his place in a sense. But then towards the end of that, the culture starts kind of bringing him back into the fold, bringing him back into the culture. And so there's this kind of structured way that he comes back into culture and reassumes his role as the leader of this tribe. I guess the main point of bringing this up is that in these states of non-ordinary consciousness, the container that's holding the whole experience really, really matters. So if there isn't enough of a container, going into these non-ordinary states of consciousness can be a little bit too entropic, a little bit too disorganized. And there isn't a clear direction for it. And there isn't necessarily even a safe experience for someone to have that. Because if you think about like taking psychedelics, you can really like lose a sense of reality and do things that are very unsafe. That's perhaps the most, like as far as we know, psychedelics, most of them are not, there is no lethal dose of them. Like from taking them, it's not the drug that's going to kill you. But some of the things you think could kill you, if you think that you can fly or something, you jump out a window, that could kill you. So it's that sense of like how safe we create the container. But that's something that I think that we're trying to do with the clinical trials is try to figure out, okay, how do we have these experiences in a way that's actually going to help people? And that's where I think the value lies in doing the studies with them and doing the research rather than just saying like, oh, let's legalize this and let everyone have access, because that's not going to go well for a lot of people. Like some people can handle that. Some people would be able to do that. Some people have that experience. But without the proper sort of guardrails, people can become really decentered by these kind of experiences. So having the proper way of like entering these non-ordinary states of consciousness, you know, the therapeutic container goes a lot in that direction of, okay, you're doing this with the explicit purpose of kind of helping heal these like these symptoms you're experiencing that are affecting your life, bringing you out of your depression, reducing anxiety, etc. And then having them take them in a very controlled physical environment where they're not able to go hurt themselves or hurt other people. And the integration afterwards, just such an important part of it. Having a proper structure around that also allows, like, you know, people go into these experiences, they have all these insights, but if you don't do anything about them, they wouldn't repair your anxiety buffer, as we were saying. Because if we're looking at mental health as like a malfunctioning anxiety buffer or like maladaptive ways of managing death anxiety, we're trying to repair that anxiety buffer. We're trying to get a worldview belief that you can live up to and gain your self-esteem and everything that kind of also needs to fit with the culture. And that's like kind of this hard thing sometimes, because sometimes, I mean, this could go down a whole other rabbit hole, but sometimes it's actually the culture that makes people sick. And I think that's one of the huge factors is like, if a culture is telling people, this is what you should believe, this is what you should do, this is how you gain a sense of value. But then at the same time, the culture doesn't provide a way for you to actually do that. Like we see in a like hyper-capitalist society where it's like gaining money is a sense is like, that's what you do. That's your sense of value. But like the jobs don't really pay that well, or like things cost so much that it's just unaffordable and stuff. That's, I mean, we could go into a huge rabbit hole with that one, but it becomes hard when like the function, what you're trying to do is repair a person's anxiety buffer, have them develop some sense of like worldview beliefs that help them. But like ultimately at the same time, like you're going to go back into a culture, you're going to live in a society. So it needs to be this like, how do you do that in a way where it's still in alignment with like what you believe, but like also you can make a living in the society and the culture that you happen to live in. But anyways, like the whole purpose of integration is that it's to try to like take those insights from a person's non-ordinary state and help them integrate it into their belief system in a way that helps them manage death anxiety better so that those symptoms don't come back, so that the symptoms that they were experiencing can kind of fall away of their own weight. Because the perspective here is that we're treating the cause, not the symptoms, whereas a lot of clinical psychology is more focused on symptom treatment, symptom reduction. But since the DSM and clinical psychology doesn't really take a perspective on what the cause is, that's not where their focus is. They're focused on symptoms, which is honestly, it's great a lot of the time and it works a lot of the time. But I think that's one of the major differences with psychedelics is that we're focusing a little bit more on underlying causes than simple symptom reduction. But to get there, we need to properly integrate these insights. And integration, part of the way I define that is like integrating both what someone wants to do intrinsically and where they're at in their culture, because like it needs to be a combination. And those things need to be integrated and fit somehow together.
So it sounds like you're saying that, you know, even with these very experiential modes of transcendence, that a container, the cultural beliefs that are accessible for how we manage death anxiety and just structure out their experiences are really crucial. It seems like for a lot of people that clinical environment can help provide that structure, because then people are going in there with a clear sort of intention and framework to make sense, even very confusing experiences. But I also understand that some of your research explored sort of what happened when people were using psychedelics in less structured settings. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so I did some research with, it was more like field research where I was, because I was, as I was saying earlier, it's a really hard thing to study because it's hard to have people have these kind of experiences in the lab. So part of the way that I got around that was by going out to the places where people are having these kind of experiences and trying to study them there. So I was like, okay, where are people taking a lot of psychedelics? Music festivals. So I got to go to a music festival and I was doing a questionnaire. This was a pre-post type study. So I went to the music festival and asked people to fill out a survey like at the beginning of the festival. And then I contacted them like the week after the festival and then 1 month after the festival. So I had three data time points to try to figure out like, do beliefs change after these experiences? And like, does it measure up with like how much of an experientially transcendent experience they had at the festival? And I mean, that was a really fun study to do. Getting out there and like actually talking with people was really rewarding, but it was hard because for two main reasons. One is that most of my hypotheses were developed with a clinical population in mind, meaning like people have some diagnosis of mental health disorders, whereas the people I was studying at the festival didn't necessarily have that. Like I didn't necessarily know if they had some sort of diagnosis. And then the other thing was that this is also not a psychedelically naive population, which I think really matters when asking some of the questions that I was asking. So some of my hypotheses didn't really turn out as I was hoping. And that's what I wrote up in my like dissertation and stuff. Those are the studies I did. But the idea is that having these experientially transcendent moments increases people's intrinsic sense of self, their intrinsic valuation, they're more oriented towards intrinsic goals, which are kind of like intrinsic goals are like a sense of health, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, whereas extrinsic goals are like money, fame, appearance. And the reason that having a psychedelically naive population would have been helpful is that like the people I was studying have already taken psychedelics before and most of them were veteran users. asked that question. There was only, I think, out of the, oh, I forget the numbers now. I think I surveyed somewhere around 60 people. It was 100 total, but I think 40 or so of them were under the influence when I asked them. So you can't actually participate because you need to, in order to consent to participate in research, you have to be of sound mind. And if you're under the influence of drugs, you can't participate while actively under the influence. So there were quite a few people who would. Anyways, somewhere around 60 people filled out the survey, and I think it was two were psychedelically naive. The rest were like moderately to veteran experience. So one of the consequences of that, one of the things that seems to be the case, I was able to do some analyses that kind of suggested this, is that maybe their prior use of psychedelics already shifted them in this direction of intrinsic motivation, intrinsic goals and stuff. So if they're, because they pretty much maxed out the intrinsic orientation measure at time one, which leaves very little room for that number to go up at time three. So that's part of why I wasn't able to get the results I was hoping for, is that they were already about as high as you could get on the intrinsic measures that I was using.
Mm.
And I also did a study with breathwork, more transcendent forms of breathwork, where people go in and do like this kind of circular breathing for 40 plus minutes. And the same thing sort of ended up happening with those results, is that the people doing that, since this is also a self-selection bias, where like the people in these studies aren't randomly selected, they're not randomly assigned a condition, they've self-selected into participate in breathwork. And so they too were like really experienced in non-ordinary states of consciousness. So again, they kind of maxed out. I'd used a different measure of intrinsic valuation and stuff, and same sort of thing happened. So it was a tricky thing to study, but yeah, I was trying to do some research out in the field, so to speak.
So you were hoping that you would see that people having the experientially transcendent experiences would somehow become more intrinsically motivated, meaning more sort of willing to just go and do things regardless of what the external reward is. And because people were already so motivated, it seems you didn't have that much of an effect, both with psychedelics and breathwork.
Yeah.
It's still really quite, I think, something to think about, because you know, most psychedelic use, people make a lot of fuss over the clinical trials, and those are critical, of course, but where is the bulk of psychedelic use actually happening? and what sort of effect is that having on people?
Yeah, because we were just talking about how, like, it without the proper container, things can sort of go off the rails. People can become really decentered. And I don't know, I that might be happening for some people in that festival setting. But if you live in, if your friend group that you surround yourself with are all kind of like in that state, it wouldn't be so, it wouldn't affect your life so much, because you're kind of surrounding yourself by people who know how to hold that together. But then where that comes in, I don't know, where that doesn't fit so well is like, if you're going back into the culture and the society, you're trying to make a living, trying to earn money and stuff. And if you're not able to function in a like normal job because you've become like you've become so, I don't know, quote unquote uncontrollable, because you're just so in touch with like, this is what I want to do, and like, I don't want to do what you tell me sort of thing, it could cause a sort of rub keeping a sort of stable job for some people. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I wasn't studying that, so I don't know.
I mean, you certainly hear stories about people doing ayahuasca and then going to become like shamans, quote unquote,
yeah,
and whatnot, and upending their lives. But
yeah,
I don't know. Did you see that people were having any sort of negative effects that you could measure with your study? Or?
The only way that I tried to figure that out is if people had... So there are two components of it. One was I was asking if people sought out some sort of help during the festival, like during their experience, because most festivals offer some sort of harm reduction services, where like if a person is having a bad trip, a hard time, they can go seek out them. None of my participants sought out those services during the festival. But then the other part where I gathered data that kind of suggests that was the qualitative stuff, was that people answered questions just kind of open-ended. And this wasn't a huge, I didn't like do a really in-depth analysis of that in my write-up, but there were things that people were talking about, and it was pretty mild. People would report feeling a little bit like, I don't know, it was really mixed, because like some people felt a lot more connected to people afterwards, but then some people reported feeling a little bit more disconnected from like the people who were close to them afterwards, in a sense of like, I'm trying to remember back now, it was more of a like sense of existential isolation almost, where it's like this sense of you don't understand me, like these people don't understand me. And so like, and that's something that can happen, I think, from these experiences, that like you might, if you develop new beliefs about things, it might lead to wanting to hang out with different kinds of people, because like I say, like we typically try to surround ourselves with people who believe really similar things. And so if you have these kind of experiences and try to come back and hang out with the same sort of people, but you're like trying to change and orient yourself towards believing in some different things, it could be really hard if you're still hanging out with the same people. And so, I mean, that gets into some really complicated things in the realm of integration after these experiences, is like, okay, if we're changing our worldview beliefs, like that can be a really big thing. And depending on how big of a shift people are making, it might lead to some big shifts in their lives, you know, changing jobs. Some people, I mean, this, some people separate from their spouses or their partners after these kind of experiences for various reasons. Like the general recommendation is to like not make any major life decisions within like the first month after you have an experience like this. Like, you know, just let it settle a little bit. But then like maybe after that, like you're still thinking that like, you know what, like this job or this city that I'm living in, like that it's not really serving the sort of things I want to be doing with my life. Like maybe I need to move. Maybe I need to hang out with different people. Like it can lead to really big shifts. So I think my own personal, I didn't do like in-depth data analyses on these things, because they weren't the questions I was asking. It was just like things I was noticing, but that could have been pointing to that. It could have been pointing to like, you know, we make these big shifts. Like you might start feeling less connected to some of the same things you were previously, and people would experience that as a bad thing, maybe in that moment. But yeah, there's lots of ways people could be engaging with those.
Yeah, I guess it just kind of goes to show that these big changes in belief that are possible, along with having high intrinsic motivation, that can be a recipe for also not being so happy as well. But I guess it just depends. Or, you know, it seems like some people in your sample probably didn't change all that much. And that's something worth thinking about as well. Going back a bit, I understand that you also looked at breath work. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that and why you thought that was a relevant thing to study.
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, there's lots of different ways to enter these non-ordinary states of consciousness where if we're looking at, you know, in a research setting, especially in a mental health context, we're interested in what can, you know, reduce a person's symptoms or treat these underlying causes, help them experience life in a way that's less distressing. And so if we're doing that, you know, not everybody's going to want to snowboard, not everybody's going to skydive. And also, like, what's actually the like clinical utility of stuff like that? Like, maybe you can get a little rush for a little moment. But if we're trying to make a change to, like, if the goal is repairing a person's anxiety buffer again, what are the tools of non-ordinary states of consciousness? What methods of accessing non-ordinary states of consciousness are most likely to have that effect? So yeah, some of those methods aren't, it's not as easy to see the path to like repairing a person's anxiety buffer. You know, dancing and singing are awesome and they're great. And maybe they can help like kind of like as a maintenance sort of tool. But if we're looking at these like heavy hitting, predictable ways of accessing non-ordinary states of consciousness, I think psychedelics and breathwork are the two main ones that are up there. And part of the reason I think breathwork is even more interesting to study and maybe even more, I don't know, it's more accessible. Everybody breathes. You don't need to find drugs and then like make sure that the drugs are safe and everything. And then like have somebody, you know, administer them and stuff to buy them from. They cost money. Breathing is free. Everybody can do it. It's much harder to make illegal. Although France did try it. You know, fun little fact that because they, France had a rule of something like they deem something legal if it's connected to like cult-like behaviors or something. So they associated the breath work with like some sort of cult or something and like tried to make it illegal for that. But it's a little bit more like accessible for people, but it is more involved. It's also more like controllable. So like if you're having a hard time on a psychedelic, you can't just like jump off of that train. You got to ride it to the next stop. Whereas breath work, if you're having a really intense experience and you want something a little more, like if you want to level out a little bit more, just stop doing the breath work. Just come back to breathing normally and you come back pretty quick. Anyways, I kind of get ahead of myself. These more transcendent forms of breath work, when done for extended periods of time, can induce very similar states of mind as a psychedelics. And it's, oh my gosh, what was the name? Conscious connected breathwork, holotropic breathwork. These are ways of breathing where it's like in through the nose, out through the mouth. And there's some variations on this. Sometimes it's just through the nose or just through the mouth. But the idea is that you're kind of over-oxygenating your blood or something. I didn't get into the physiology of it. I'm a psychologist. But you take in a lot of oxygen and chemical stuff happens in the brain. I don't know what's going on there. I think it'd be really awesome if some more neuroscientists would study it. But the phenomenological experience that people experience, so like the actual like a person's experience of their whatever experience they're having, that's what I was more interested in. And that experience is very similar to psychedelics in the sense that you can have these kind of out-of-body type experiences. You can kind of experience things in a dreamlike way. You can have past life experiences, as some people call them. So yeah, like really similar things happen. Like people can get really emotional. You get into these emotional experiences where it's just like overwhelming. People will weep and people will cry. People will laugh. And yeah, you do that all while just laying on the floor, usually with a blindfold. There's often music playing in the background, just like they do for a lot of the psychedelic trials. Usually a facilitator. I think it's better if there's a facilitator guiding the experience. Yeah, so I studied that partly as a way of like, okay, I think we need to learn more about breath work because I think it's a much more, it's more economical, it's more accessible. I think we should be studying this. It's just maybe a little less appealing because it's less, you know, it's, people are stand to make less money off of it because if it's just free and accessible, there's going to be a lot less people funding that sort of research because people stand to make less money off of it, which is unfortunate. But yeah, that's why I wanted to study it.
So it sounds like you could just have basically a psychedelic like experience from something that is free and accessible. And in your research, you were able to easily do this. People were able to have mystical type experiences, right?
They did, yeah. And the way that I did it was I teamed up with some breathwork facilitators who guide, like they're already trained, they already have their clients and their business and everything. And I teamed up with them and had their clients had the option to participate in my study. So these are people who are already signed up to do the breath work. They were going to do the breath work anyways. And just like, hey, if you want to, you could also participate in this research. So those are the people that I studied. And like it was, again, I forget the exact numbers, but somewhere in the range of like over 75% of people, I used the mystical experience questionnaire, and it was over 75% of people met criteria for full-blown mystical experience from breathwork.
That's wild. I mean, I bet part of it was, you know, going into the breathwork, there was sort of a container or priming that, oh, this is going to be a meaningful, impactful experience. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know?
That could definitely be a part of it, because like that is one of the instructions that all of the breathwork facilitators, all three of the facilitators that I teamed up with, they do. And I think it's responsible to do it, is like giving some sort of primer of like what to expect. And so it's so people aren't going into these experiences with a totally like not knowing what to expect. So, yeah, maybe there are some expectancy effects there. But I think it would be unsafe to not give people some of those expectations of like what to expect. I don't know. It'd be hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I just imagine hypothetically would be interesting is to design a breathwork technique that's not really a breathwork technique, and then read people those instructions, and then see,
Yeah, for that dissertation study, I thought about doing that, but it would have been, you know, dissertation, you're under a time crunch, I want to graduate, that's what matters at most at the end of the day. Like that. So the study design I ended up going up with was a little bit more, it was more reasonable. But what I wanted to do, I would have loved to get a more experimental design where I have like, say, a breathwork facilitator leading two sessions on like two different days or something. One is the experimental group, one is the control group. And they get basically all of the same instructions beforehand. But then in the actual thing, like one person gets the actual, like one group gets the actual breath work. And the other gets like a, like they're still breathing, but it's not the actual techniques that are going to get you into that state. So it's just like basically a really boring breath meditation to see like, okay, like they had the same expectancy going into it. But like one group did the actual like transcendent breath work and the other was just sitting there, I don't know, breathing normally, basically, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I thought about that. I would have liked to do that, but didn't have the time.
Expectancies aren't necessarily a bad thing. You know, if they're catalyzing helpful experiences for people, then why not? Even though it might make research a bit messier.
Yeah, yeah.
Another sort of thing I just keep thinking about is you're like, you've mentioned skydiving a few times and you're jumping out of a plane. Obviously, maybe that is producing some sort of effect on death anxiety. So I don't know if you could tell us about that. I know I would be thinking about dying jumping out of a plane.
Yeah. Yeah. I had several conversations with my PhD advisor about like potential studies we could do, like studying the skydiving population, but it didn't end up doing them for various reasons. But yeah, it's like kind of you're playing with death, you're tempting death in a sense, but it's also a pretty safe hobby at the end of the day. Like it's not
a safe hobby.
There's a lot of like skydiving out of a plane. You have two parachutes. There's like a fail-safe mechanism in your parachute where like if you don't pull your parachute at a certain altitude, it automatically deploys your reserve parachute. And the parachutes you're jumping on are typically pretty big. So you're like, it's plenty safe. The mortality rate in skydiving is actually a lot less than like, you know, driving. Driving is more dangerous than skydiving. So like, if you look at the stats, it's actually not that dangerous, but I get the point. It's like, yeah, you're jumping out of an airplane, falling thousands of feet. And it is a huge rush. Obviously, like it's definitely an adrenaline filled activity. Upon further analysis, it felt like it had less like relevance to like to the research with like death anxiety and that than it felt like it should. But because like seasoned skydivers, like we're out there having fun. It's like just like any other hobby at the end of the day, where it's like, yeah, because like we have our gear, we're out there to have fun. At that point, it's more about like getting better at learning the skills and like gaining more control in the air, trying to do cooler stunts with more people. Like as a skydiver, like your goal is to more like, I don't know, get better at your discipline. So there's like belly flying where like your belly is towards the ground. There's sit flying where like your head is up in the air and your feet are down here. And so you're like kind of in this seat flying through the air. There's head down. There's back flying. There's like angle dives. There's wingsuits, pretty big on YouTube and stuff. There's formation flying where you jump with multiple people. And all those things require different skills. So like body control and stuff. So the sport becomes more about just becoming a better flyer, like better at controlling your canopy. Once you're in the canopy, some people really like getting smaller and smaller parachutes so that when you're coming down to land, you're landing a lot faster. So you get a lot more speed and you can do stuff in the air that makes you go even faster. And they call it swooping. You get near the ground and like go 100 feet or so on the ground, like inches off the ground at a really fast speed under canopy. So there's lots of different disciplines, and that's what a skydiver is interested in, kind of just like any other hobby, where it's like, if you're mountain biking, you're trying to get better, trying to ride more technical trails. Snowboarding, it's like same sort of thing. There's more technical trails, like, can you go through this tree run without hitting a tree? There's skills you're learning along the way. So like to the skydiver, it's not like we don't think about the fact that we're tempting death or anything. Like that's a lot about the like perception that people have of us. Like I've had people think that like there have been people who like think that skydivers are like mentally unstable, mentally ill or something, and that it's like some sort of disease or disorder. But I don't know, when you're in the culture, again, it's like that's the culture we're in. We don't see it that way. It's just a very different experience.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's more of an experience about mastery and skill building than any sort of like experiential, transcendent, mystical type thing, I suppose.
Yeah, and it is definitely one that's a little bit more likely to like force you into a non-ordinary state, in the sense that like, because, you know, riding your bike down the street isn't necessarily like forcing every ounce of your attention to be on what you're doing in that moment. But if you're skydiving, it is a little bit more of a like in your face sort of experience that like it's hard to think about other stuff while you're doing it. And so in that sense, like, I guess I would say I like doing the sort of activities that are more likely to kind of force me into that kind of state of mind. Like that's what I think adrenaline junkie, like that being called that, is more seeking, like the sort of experiences that force that state of mind upon you, whereas others take a little bit more time. Because like you can definitely get to that state riding a bike. You can get to that state knitting. Like if you're knitting and crocheting or something, like that's a really like repetitive thing too, that can get you in that kind of state of mind where you're just like not thinking about anything else. It's just the needles going through the thread or whatever it is.
The yarn, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So flow states, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd be thinking about dying if I was to jump out of a plane, but I still want to do it at some point. At some point, I need to get a parachute and jump out of a plane.
It's a good time. It's really fun. The culture around it's really fun, too. Yeah, one of my favorites, just because it's relevant, one of my favorite skydives, it was just the ride to altitude, the ride up on the plane, was fun to me because I was sitting in the plane that I was in. It was a Twin Otter, so the seats are on the outside of the plane and like you're kind of facing the middle. So like you're looking at each other, and directly across from me was I think it was a priest. The ones that wear the white collar. Are those priests? I don't
know. Yeah.
But he wanted to do a skydive. And I've never seen anybody look that ghostly white the whole time. Like he was terrified. And I mean, people get scared a lot of the time. Like some people go entirely nonverbal, like you're trying to talk to them and they're like deer in a headlights. Like they're just elsewhere. They're totally like terrified beyond being able to talk or comprehend anything. And he was definitely in that state. And his tandem instructor, the person that, because he was doing a tandem jump where he's just strapped to somebody's chest. And the instructor was like trying to like calm his nerves by making some jokes and stuff, but they just didn't land. He was kind of like halfway smiling, but I think that was only because everybody else was. I don't think he actually heard what was going on, but it was a memorable experience for me.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like the setup to like some sort of joke, like a priest gets on a plane to skydive.
Yeah, something.
I mean, was it always for you something where it was more about skill building? Like, were you terrified the first time you did it, or?
You know, I wasn't. It was always like I knew before I did my first jump that I wanted to get into the sport as like a hobby. So I actually signed up for and paid in advance for like the entire, I forget what it's called now, like basic jumper course or something like that, where at the drop zone I was going to is a lot different than I think a lot typically are, because it was a smaller drop zone that was not affiliated with the USPA, which is like the governing body over skydiving. So they had a little bit more leniency about what they did. I paid for the whole thing in advance. So I like paid for a handful of jumps in advance. I paid for all the training you get, because there's a lot of ground school that you go through to learn about the different malfunctions that could happen. I paid for all of it in advance. And then my first jump was, it was out of a Cessna. So it's a little 4-seater plane. So there's like the pilot cockpit and then like the people sitting behind it. And then there's a door over here and the wing is above the door. And then there's a strut that goes from like the bottom of the door out to the wing, holds the wing up. Climbing, my first jump was that I climb out and I hold onto that strut. And then I'm just kind of dangling in the wind. And the person on the inside, my instructor, has my pilot chute in his hand, which is like what you pull. I toss out a pilot chute and it's basically a small pilot, a small parachute. And that's what pulls my larger parachute out of the container that's on my back. He has that pilot chute in his hand. And then all I have to do is let go of the strut and just like maintain the proper body position for when your parachute comes out. And he lets go of my pilot chute so that my parachute just comes out automatically. There's no free fall. And for that, yeah, I was more just like excited and focused on like what I got to do.
Mm.
I was just like practicing my training. But some of the stories are kind of funny of like the different experiences you like those instructors get of people. And it's like a very telling, it's pretty obvious like who's going to do well and who's not based on like what you can see in their eyes in that moment when they're hanging from the wing of the plane. Because like one of the pieces of feedback I got was that like, oh, like you were really present, like you were really listening to what I was saying. Like I would say something and you would nod in response and stuff. But some people and some students that first time, like, they think they're going to do fine, but then they end up being terrified and they don't like that's like I was saying with that priest, like they're just like deer in a headlights, like not present. So he would tell me about a student who wasn't letting go when they were supposed to let go. It was like, okay, like on the count of three, like let go and I'll let go of your pilot chute. And they weren't letting go. They were just holding on like death grip. But at that point, it's unsafe to try to get them back in the plane because there's all sorts of things that could go wrong with that. And then a parachute could, because his parachute's already out, like that pilot chute's already out, so that could get tangled in something and it could cause problems with the plane. So he had to pry his fingers off one at a time, and then like the pilot was like kind of shaking the plane a little bit to shake him off, and it's like you're going whether you like it or not. So you get those sort of people too. But yeah,
man, I would love to see some studies of that, you know, just the range of behaviors people exhibit, you know, prior to skydiving and all of that. It sounds like it could be quite predictive maybe of somebody's psychological framework, just hypothetically.
I think that'd be really fascinating, because then you also have the people who pass out under parachute, because it's part of it's like the G-force that you get from doing some of the spins. You know, you're under parachute, and if you pull one of your toggles, you start turning, and that adds G-force to your, because you're like, now you're like turning and adding speed, because you're also now, what you're doing is you're closing off a couple cells on your canopy, and so you start falling faster too, because you're turning. And So now you're going faster and you're turning so that G-force kind of can. It's like when pilots in fighter planes, people might be familiar with the fact that like when you go really fast on those or like you pull a maneuver, like you experience a lot of G-force. And so they have to do these special breathing techniques just to stay conscious. It's the same sort of thing at a lesser extent, but that makes some people pass out. And so I've had friends who are tandem instructors and they, you know, they're like trying to give their tandem student a good time, have a fun time. So they do some spins and circles or whatever, but the person passes out and it's pretty obvious at that moment. Cause like they're sitting, their head's like right in front of you. And all of a sudden their head just like goes down. It's like, hey buddy, are you still there? Are you still awake? Some people pass out. Some people of course throw up, which is unfortunate. Cause you're like, you're moving forward as you're, so you have forward momentum. So if you throw up, it just all comes right back at you, which can suck. So yeah, there's a range of things that people experience. But I think it's generally like once people are actually on the ground and safe back on the ground, the response is pretty unanimous. Like people had like they just loved it and had a great time with few exceptions where people are just like, oh, my God, I never want to do that again. But yeah, I think people generally love the experience.
Mm.
See, it'd be fun to do an experiment where you like have a video of like looking at the person and like based on like certain features of like their eyes or something or different reactions they're having, like does that predict, it's like a personality study. Are there different personality types? Is your personality predicted by your response to skydiving?
Yeah, I mean, quite the range of experiences, psychedelics, breathwork, skydiving.
It's a fun life. You only get to live it once.
Do you have, I don't know, anything else you think is interesting or relevant to mention?
I think just if there's a message for people, it's to be safe and think through what you're doing. We're talking about a lot of things that do have, they're fun. A lot of these things are really fun. You know, skydiving's fun, snowboarding's fun, and psychedelics can be fun. But there's also obvious risks and dangers to these things. So just think through them, be prepared, and be smart, take a friend. That would be my message.
What about, I guess, applying terror management theory and existential psychology, what takeaways can people have from those perspectives to improve their lives?
You know, there actually is, I'm maybe answering a slightly different question here with it, but something I just thought of is the role of culture in these kind of transcendent experiences and how, like, in the course of history, these rituals and especially, like, any use of psychedelics in a cultural context has had a lot of cultural context around it. So the people going into the experiences, there's this extra, like the entire community and the entire culture around them has some sense of like knowing what to expect. They all kind of play a part in the experience. And that goes a long way in having better outcomes. So one of the challenges nowadays is that our culture has a lot of mixed opinions about psychedelics for lots of different reasons. And so there's some challenges there, but especially when like, you know, if you want to go do, if say like a person is having symptoms of mental health that they want to help and they want to go get a psychedelic treatment because of it, it might be hard to talk about that with some people in your social circles because of their beliefs about psychedelics. And that could be a really isolating experience. So it's kind of one of the challenges to overcome with psychedelics these days. So it's like almost an unfortunate burden that some of the people doing these psychedelic trials have to bear is that like it's kind of on them to also then educate people around them to the extent that they're capable and willing. But part of where this conversation goes is that one of the things that I would like to see in psychedelic trials more, which is again like a really hard thing to study in a controlled scientific environment, a controlled lab setting, is having more of a community aspect to the experience. So right now it's like one therapist and one person or two therapists and like one person going through the experience and it, like in this room by themselves, which is like relatively isolated compared to like a lot of indigenous ways of doing these things, things that have been around for a long time, is that they do these things in a group setting. So there's a bunch of people all kind of going through the experience at the same time together. That's going to lead to different experiences. And I think one of the benefits of adding more people in, especially when it's like your own community, your own culture, is that everybody's kind of going through it together. Everybody kind of has a sense of what each other went through. And, you know, you go through the process of setting intentions together. You go through the process of like kind of integrating together. And I think there's a lot to be said about that, just the added value that we get from doing it in community and doing it together, that like the current model of trials, because like one of the things that I fear with the psychedelic trials is that the way that we're doing things in the lab for the clinical research is that like that's going to be taken as like that is how it needs to be done on the outside. Because that's what's empirically validated. That's what's like, we know that like doing things in this specific way is what leads to these outcomes. But what we miss there is that like, unfortunately, there aren't going to be many experiments that look at a larger community group setting, because that's harder to do an experiment on. That's harder to do a controlled experiment with. But I think there's a lot of value in doing that. So I think finding more of a balance in that, knowing, like, remembering to, you know, bring, you know, go with a friend. Like I was saying, like if you're doing these experiences, I think it helps to have other people know that you're doing it, to be part of the integration and everything, to help you kind of put your life back together after the fact. That's what I would like to see more of.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't be as fun to just skydive for your first time out of a plane alone, you know, like that would not be a fun time. There definitely is some, I think, research incorporating more community elements. Like I know there was a study with demoralization among AIDS survivors, and that had a community support element. So hopefully more trials start implementing that sort of structure to them. There are all sorts of, you know, barriers about conducting a research study that make you know, that sort of study design challenging, but you know, it can be done, I think. Well, thank you so much for all your fascinating talk, descriptions of various forms of death transcendence and skydiving stories. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me on here, Haley. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Bye.
All right, take care.